Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 14th of January 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're joined by David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives. Brexit, I suppose.
Depressingly enough, yes. We'll start off with Theresa May, of course, the meaningful vote. I still don't know where that term came from or why it's called the meaningful vote, but the meaningful vote will take place tomorrow, widely expected to lose it. Well, Mr. Corbyn said that if she does lose it, when she does lose it, he's going to call a vote of no confidence in the government. Of course, it's actually a vote of confidence. This is all part of the Fixed Term Parliaments Act. And he will call the vote this time, apparently, on the government as opposed to on Theresa May, which is what he tried the last time. Really a pointless exercise. But anyway, Theresa May was giving her last-ditch speech this morning in Stoke-on-Trent in an attempt to revive, get another couple of votes so that she doesn't end up with hundreds of people voting against her. Well, she said that MPs blocking Brexit is now a more likely scenario than a no deal. So second referendum or just revoking Article 50 is more likely, she seems to think, at the moment. But in the meantime, there's been an exchange of letters between her and the European Union. So she's written to them, they've written to her. And their letter is probably the more important because this is their attempt to try to give the UK Parliament something which will allow them to vote for her deal. So she said during her speech this morning that the letters the EU have sent today have legal force. So the letters came from these two, hand in hand, Jean-Claude Juncker and Donald Tusk. And these are the main points that they said. The EU is willing to extend the transition period. The EU is ready to sign the withdrawal agreement. Good stuff. The EU is ready to agree a future trade agreement. And the EU does not wish to see the backstop enter into force. But if it does, it'll be for the shortest possible period. And I suppose the point that they're trying to make here is that the backstop is there in the withdrawal agreement, but they are ready to press ahead with every possible future agreement, and that includes a trade agreement which would make the backstop unnecessary. So they're trying to persuade parliamentarians that they don't need to be concerned about the backstop at all. Very interestingly enough, Brian, not a word of military union or defence or security in these letters. This is still off the table as far as Brexit is concerned. But really, the pantomime continues. We'll see what happens tomorrow.
You've used the word pantomime, shambles, chaos. What else have I heard over the last few days? Many different descriptions. But when I think back, as I do regularly now, to when we had a country which seemed to be able to conduct its own affairs, seemed to be able to run its own politics, seemed to be able to at least run, for example, an NHS or the military or the roads. And now we've got a government that is simply, on the surface, incapable of pulling us out of this so-called common market. That's what we were sold. David, I'm watching your expression on the other camera. This is not accidental, what we're experiencing at the moment. Surely it's not accidental.
Well, when you look in the sort of, you know, judging by their actions, and certainly we know we've got the well-established litmus test now. Of are they talking about military unification? So no, they're not. So obviously, then they're May and her entourage, her regime, are clearly treading the boards for rejoining the EU, and they're not really bothered anyway. They do that, whether that's done through more parliamentary shenanigans that we're now seeing being pushed by Grieve and Letwin. There seem to be two key players. Whether that goes to a general election or whatever, it doesn't seem to make a great deal of difference. The backstop, just let me come in on that. The backstop lets everybody understand that's rejoining the EU. That's what that is. And of course, it's then going in with military. So that's the second key component to becoming a federal state.
So, David, just before you continue with that, I'll just mention this. The backstop clearly preparations being made for that, because when I was over in Northern Ireland over Christmas, I was told quite clearly that customs posts are being built at Larne Harbour and other harbours in the in Northern Ireland. So preparations being made for that. Would they be spending this money if they weren't pretty certain of some kind of outcome?
Absolutely. That's a clear litmus test there, Mike. You know, they wouldn't be doing that if they didn't already know what the answer is going to be. So it's regardless of whatever, as Brian is to say, they're the pantomime that we're seeing with this puppet. Interesting, you use that sort of pantomime of puppet, bit John Redwood there. Puppet Parliament with these puppet MPs who are about to play more puppetry with the general public. You know, most of the sort of dialogue I've had here locally with people are clearly seeing through this now. And a lot of people are saying to me, well, the vote's irrelevant because they're making any kind of democratic job redundant. You know, your vote doesn't count for nothing. You don't count for nothing. So, this week's going to be a really crucial week in British history, because as a nation, as we keep saying, you know, we're seeing the lights gradually going out on that basis of being a nation.
Yeah. Well, on the subject of EU military unification, something is going on in the background, which seems certainly the BBC doesn't want to talk about. Now, I pop this up with an apology. I've got the word on in there, shouldn't really be there, but basically a BBC wall of silence as France and Germany sign up to the Aachen Treaty. And I had to use Google because I think most people would. So I simply searched for the BBC and the Aachen Treaty to see what we could find. Well, the first one that popped up was back in November 1998, and there wasn't anything current. And if it hadn't have been for the eagle eyes of David Scott over the weekend, we wouldn't be able to report this to you today. But what are we talking about? Well, we're talking about this extremely high level political love affair reported here with Bloomberg. France and Germany need to do more than renew their vows. It goes on to say Macron and Angelini Merkel's attempt to make an example of their cooperation faces too many obstacles. So that interesting headline, but it didn't really do justice to what was under the surface. But what a lovely picture, Mike. She's almost nuzzling his ear there, trying to get closer. Here's the Durand getting closer to the truth. France, Germany to merge economic and defence policies to create cross-border Euro districts. Now, let's remember that one of the policies that was pushed immensely hard in UK was effectively to get rid of our counties and to bring in the regions, the English regions, which was fully in line with European policy. Now we see what this really entails within Europe itself, because France and Germany getting together to sign a document which is going to basically start to dismantle them as nation states. I'll just put in a little bit of black humour there because I couldn't resist it. When I looked for BBC material on this treaty, which is planned to be signed, discussed and signed around the 22nd of January, I found this wonderful video clip where a French lady, 101 years old, asked Angela Merkel whether she was Mrs. Macron. I encourage people to go and find this little clip because it's so delightful.
So who was 101 years old? The French lady?
The little Angela, French lady there.
So, right, yeah. not Mrs. Merkel or Macron's wife.
Well, it could be, but the little old French lady got a little bit confused, and she looked at Angela Merkel and asked her whether she was Mrs. Macron, to which we say, well, why wouldn't she assume this? So I think we're on the same par. But let's have a look at this treaty, which the illustrious BBC, and it appears that much of other UK mainstream media, as it's called, simply doesn't want to go there. Now, this is some of the key bits that were passed through to us at the weekend. So let's have a look. So Paris and Berlin herald a new era of integration, two nations to share defence, foreign and economic policies. Germany and France are set to forge a pact aligning their defence, diplomatic and economic policies in an unprecedented twinning pact. It's regarded as a prototype for the future of the European Union, according to the Times. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron will sign the Aachen Treaty later this month, which will govern a coordinated diplomatic front as well as joint actions on peacekeeping missions. And then the next bit, which jumped out at me, militarily, the treaty aims to form a, quote, common culture and common deployments in overseas engagement. The brief document will be signed on January the 22nd in Aachen, the ancient German spa city near the borders with Belgium and the Netherlands. It is meant to be ratified by the two national governments, parliaments, that same day. And before we bring David back in, we'll just go on to the second bit here. The new treaty is a commitment to a strong, sustainable and sovereign Europe, said the German government in a press release, adding that the two countries have agreed to the new treaty to, quote, deepen the integration of their economies towards a German-French economic area with, quote, common rules. German Foreign Minister Mr. Maas on Wednesday told the redactions Netzwerk Deutschland, a local media group, that the new German-French treaty will become a signal against nationalism and a great opportunity for both countries. In times when populists are once again talking about national egoism, we also unite a clear commitment. Closer cooperation works not at the expense of our sovereignty, but makes us stronger, said Maas, adding that it's about advocating a strong, empowered Europe, a peaceful world and, quote, a rule-based order. It's got all the language in it, Mike.
So just let me clarify this. It said something there about it being ratified by the French and German parliaments, admittedly on the same day, so they're not getting much opportunity to sort of read it or consider it, but it is going to be ratified.
Yes.
Well, that beats Britain then, since the Sandhurst Treaty didn't go through that type of process.
No, we'll bring that up on screen in a minute. But David, all the language is here, and I just love the deceit that on one hand you can clearly see Germany and France as nation states being dismantled to become regions of Europe, while at the same time they talk about European sovereignty to give it this veneer that nothing's really changing. This is immensely dangerous.
It's extremely dangerous, looking at the speed that they're looking to do this. So they're giving the, as you said, the language here is exquisite. It's all this exquisite EU-coded language or, you know, they start off there with integration. It's not. It's unification. And obviously, as we all know, you know, the EU is a tyrannical system. It's a non-elected tyrannical dictatorship that's soon going to be armed, fully armed. You're quite right, Brian. They're dismantling the countries of France and Germany at the point that this proceeds. They'll cease to exist as countries because they won't have command and control of their own militaries. This is this serious, and they'll ratify it the same day. So there's no, where's the resistance in those countries for them to turn around and go, no, they don't want national of anything. It doesn't matter whether it's Britain or France or Germany. We're all in the same hat, the same as America. So Heiko Maas here saying that he doesn't want nationalism. Yes, he's not kidding, isn't he? They're going to X out these nations here. They cease to be nations at this point because at the point they ratify this treaty and it comes under EU control, they will then have EU tax and an EU treasury, and that's it. It's game, set and match for the continent of Europe. And there's only one thing that this unified force is going to do. It's going to go to war because they want more change and they want to impart change upon Russia. And they're going to attempt to do it via this method. This is the modus operandi. So we're into dire straits here in Britain this week. And we look like Europe itself, the countries in Europe are in dire straits this week as well. So it's 100 years for this to come to this point, really. This thing has been being pushed around and been trying to achieve. But it definitely is not a world rules-based order. It's a new world order, and it's not very nice.
It's not very nice at all. Well, for perhaps viewers and listeners that haven't seen the wealth of information on the UK column website about EU military unification, let's just bring in a little bit on a graphic to simplify things and help people through. But we'll just say that it was the UK column that really picked up on the events in 2010, where the government, David Cameron, of course, in power, was busy ramping up this partnership with the French on all matters defence. And it was the UK column alone that exposed that much of the dirty dealing was going on, assisted by the so-called charity, the Franco-British Council, with meetings held in the ambassador's residence in France. And of course, what was being agreed is what would then go into the strategic defence review in UK, which, if you analyse it after the event, was everything possible to help push us towards unification with the European Union. So we started on the trail around about this 2010. So much information has come in since then, but let's put in a little bit of the key milestones. 2016, this was one of your articles, Mike, where you were talking about Michael Fallon having been talking about joining forces essentially with the Germans. We've got this one, March 2017, UK and Germany walk towards stronger defence relationship. And that is a little excerpt from the UK column, EU military unification timeline, which I'll show you a bit more of in due course. But March 2017, we get another very strong pointer as to what's happening here. We can hop across into 2018, and this is where the there was a meeting held at Sandhurst. That's the one you've just referred to, Mike, where we're starting to see Britain's military locked in with the French. And of course, the government only talking about France, not mentioning the EU, just trying to blind the public with this is sort of bilateral with France. No, no, this is actually to do with the European Union. Then we had David, this really extraordinary tweet from the German Foreign Ministry, which you picked up on, in which they're saying that basically there's going to be a full EU military system coming in. We've now got the latest being signed up. So notice it's done as a bilateral. This is to do with France and Germany signing. But if we look at the pieces around all of this, this is simply a smokescreen for the fact that this is all being driven ultimately for and by the EU.
Well, they have published in various places that their intention is to take these bilateral agreements and that those become a pathway towards a unified system. So they're quite open about that.
Yep, OK. And on the left, I've just brought in on screen as we were discussing that little bit, the fact that if you are going to have a full unified military system for the EU, you need to have a treasury. And that was discussed back in October 2017. Print's a little bit small, so I can't read the full detail of that. But what I can say to you is that information and a huge amount of more is available on the timeline, which you can find on the UK column. So if you're saying yes, but you're only giving us a few snippets in the news, that's absolutely correct. If you want the real detail, starting off in appropriately, I suppose, 1984 there, you can follow all of this very good analysis through, together with the links back to the original subjects.
Yes, and now look, one thing I want to mention there is that the timeline begins in 1984, Brian, but what we now know is that this unification process has been a Franco-British policy from the beginning. It's Britain and France together, and we're going to show this week, in fact, that this runs back at least to 1948.
Yes, indeed. David, it couldn't really be clearer, hidden in plain sight, what's happening here. And I know you've just given us a little summary, but all of the details are here. And as Mike said, this is a plan which goes way back. This wasn't something that's simply been cooked up since we got involved in the common market.
No, it predates the common market, and it realistically sort of its turning point was during World War II. So what do we see again? War being used for change. So the instruments that were sort of used and put into play there are really coming to affect our generation now. But it's so straightforward for everybody, regardless of whatever your interest is currently or whatever your particular field or that you're looking at, that unless this is halted or we get to a sort of level where there's something like a majority appreciates that with this one move, if it comes into play into Britain, we will cease to be a nation. It is so straightforward. You know, we had William Hague campaigning there some time ago to keep the pound. He didn't want currency union, or that's what they were saying at the time. But now we're seeing a completely covert, I think it's fair to call it covert political conduct there, that this is being done in silence, that we're about to have Her Majesty's Crown military, lock, stock and all the barrels, all of it, from nukes to boots, rolled into this arrangement. We will literally cease to be a nation very, very quickly. So all of your other interests, what do they matter at that point when someone else is commanding your military that you used to have? Now, the key thing here really is we've got to roll in the Constitution and the military union into two hats, because everybody that serves takes an oath to the crown. Now, there's the point here where all this is going to come to rest very soon, is anybody that's in currently needs to consider their position as to whether they want that to continue or not.
And David, something that we were trying to highlight last week on Thursday through a little Twitter campaign, it still staggers me to some degree that this issue is being kept out of the Brexit debate by all sides on the Brexit debate. And despite the fact that we've demonstrated that the likes of David Davis knows what the implications of this are, he knows that it's taking place, he knows it's happening, none of these people will bring this onto the table around the Brexit debate. It's still not too late to do that. So what's it going to take to get these people to open their mouths finally?
Well, it's going to take a bit more than what we're currently doing. You're right. Across the political table, the political facade of the MPs, and let's bear in mind, this is the only legitimate system or instrument that's available to the people to do anything about this. And yet the fiduciary, the MPs, are almost refusing, which is very interesting. We had Anne-Marie Trevelyan use the phrase last week, military union. So I wonder what the reaction she got from that. And our Twitter barrage last week that we engaged with her on it, that the silence here is deafening. Surely can somebody not see that this is a crucial part of our a problem at the moment? And you're right, it's being held out. It's being completely and utterly held out of the debate. It's not being evaluated. It's not being scrutinized. It's almost as if it's a fait accompli. And yet we have this glaring contradiction of leaving the EU, but actually going into military union. But in silence. So none of the people who are supposed to be doing their job are actually doing their job and actually using the magic words. I mean, surely if this would be like hitting a cow's backside with a banjo, because anybody looking for a vote one way or the other could say, well, I'm in favour of military union. I think it's a great idea. Let's do it. If you were that way inclined, let's say perhaps most, you know, a good portion of the Labour Party would want to go that way. And there's some of the, you know, I believe that fundamentally some of the other on the other spectrum would want to go and say, well, no, I'm opposed to it. Well, at least we could have the debate at that point, and the general public would then finally know that there was something coming up to get them called military union. It did infect them, because pretty soon you're going to have taxation without representation.
Yeah, David, it's absolutely true to say that proper debate would change so much. Are there members of the Labour Party that would welcome that military integration? There may be some, but I also suspect there's many of them that regard that as a very dangerous precedence. They sense, they feel that what you've got building here is a very powerful military bloc, which is going to very quickly push democracy to one side. Well, such democracy as there is. So I think that if we can get the debate out there, we're going to see all sorts of different things happen. And perhaps it's time for us to say here to our viewers and listeners that if you haven't contacted your MP to challenge them on EU military unification, you need to do it, because this really brings them under pressure. And we are seeing indications that MPs are beginning to get very, very nervous as this thing builds. There's no doubt MPs are being threatened and warned off and told to be silent on it. The public coming in and giving them support by showing what you know and what you'd like them to do could change a lot. So don't just sit at home. And at this point, I'd just like to bring in Mike, that back in, October 2017, you produced this article, "Brexit, Theresa May's cards are on the table." And you said this: "The government and mainstream media here in Britain would have us believe Brexit is a chaotic disaster. Yet behind the scenes, the military unification policy is progressing as planned and at pace." So 18 months ago, you were absolutely predicting what we now see.
Well, look, you know, if France is being taken apart as a nation state, certainly one of the things that was driving the yellow vest protests in recent weeks was some of Emmanuel Macron's comments, basically saying exactly that it's a useless construct. But anyway, he has now been brought to the table with an open letter to the French. And this is pretty hilarious, really, in many ways. So this is France 24. The headline is "Yellow Vest Protest. Macron launches national debate with open letter to the French." And they say that he on Sunday kicked off a 3-month national debate he hopes will quell the yellow vest unrest with a letter to the French in which he pledges to listen to new ideas, but he's sticking to his core economic reform agenda. So he said in the letter, "For me, there's no banned issue, so you can discuss whatever you like. We won't agree on everything, which is normal in a democracy, but at least we'll show we're a people which is not afraid of talking, exchanging, debating." Now, this is a pretty key point. We won't agree on everything which is normal in a democracy, because what he actually seems to be saying in this letter is, you won't agree with me, Macron, on everything, and I'm going to ignore your concerns, but we're going to have a conversation about it nonetheless, so you should be happy with that. So what are the types of things he's talking about? Well, he says, when taxes are too high, our economy is starved of the resources that could be usefully invested in companies creating jobs and growth. We will not undo the measures we've introduced to put this right, encourage investment and ensure that work pays more. So some of the questions he's going to ask: which taxes do you think should be lowered first? Should some public services that are out of date or too expensive be eliminated? What concrete proposals do you think would accelerate our environmental transition? So, for example, that question, there's no debate about whether there should be an environmental transition. Which concrete proposals do you think would accelerate our policy agenda? We have a policy agenda. Which are the best bits that we should accelerate? Should we use more referendums is another question he's asking in this letter. Once our asylum obligations are fulfilled, do you want Parliament to be able to set annual targets? So is that not two fingers up at the French that are concerned about the immigration problems that the French nation is having? And this is one of the core subjects which is being completely ignored by the British mainstream media when they discuss the yellow vests issue. There's no question that migration is one of the issues that is right at the top of the agenda for discussion as far as the yellow vests are concerned. But he qualifies any discussion about annual targets with it only coming after the French government's asylum obligations are fulfilled. So anything that's already policy is not up for discussion, basically. No. So how does he expect to make any progress there at all?
Well, because he's prepared to run roughshod over anybody who disagrees with those policies, I think, Mike.
And he also said we will not pursue tax cuts without lowering the overall level of our public spending. So he's talking about austerity, therefore. But in the meantime, then, well, what did we have over the weekend? This is Ruptly's coverage of alleged yellow vest attacks on journalists. So France 24 also commenting on this. Protesters also came under fire on Sunday over numerous attacks and threats against journalists across the country. Reporters Without Borders Secretary General Christophe Delwar said, as a turning point has been reached, and we call on the spokespersons of the Yellow Vests to solemnly condemn increasing violence against journalists during demonstrations. Now, of course, we can't know that the people wearing the yellow vests here were in fact protesters, or whether they were agents provocateurs. It wouldn't be the first time that that type of thing has happened. But as well as that, while I'm in no way condoning, in fact, I condemn any attacks on anybody during these protests, I condemn the attacks by the police on old people that we're seeing some of the videos
horrific.
Absolutely horrific attacks, and absolutely condemn these attacks on journalists if those are genuinely yellow vests. But the French media has been pretty aggressively anti this entire protest movement. And extremely critical of it, extremely pro-government. And so, while I condemn what they've done, it's not necessarily surprising that it's happened, that people's frustrations are getting to this stage. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Well, let's follow on from that with a little look at an article in the Daily Mail. And I have to say, we're going to ask our viewers and listeners to assist with this one because the analysis of it is very interesting. And today is really a first stab at it. But this is the headline, A Twisted Conspiracy, How Britain's Far Right Persuaded the UKIP Leader to Back an Anti-Muslim Campaign That's As Bogus As It Is Cruelly Offensive. Now, what's fascinating about this article is that you would think from the headline it's going to take the lid off something. It's going to help explain something. But as you get into the text, you find that it weaves into its own particular narrative. And I was left at the end by really wondering what the journalist had in his head as he put this thing together. But the story goes back to last year where the three young men to the left of your picture died after a car mounted the pavement in London and killed the three of them. And since that time, there's been quite a lot of controversy. The parents of some of the boys have been very outspoken, saying they don't trust the police investigation. And their case has been picked up by Tommy Robinson and other groups. And what the article in the paper is saying is that basically these extreme right wing groups are just using the family to make, if you like, make hay out of this. And the article then, of course, moves through to the fact that we've got this gentleman, James Goddard, who was the one who hounded Anna Soubry MP. He's connected to Tommy Robinson, but also he's been photographed in a pub with the mother of one of the young men who was killed alongside Gerard Batten. So the Daily Mail is crowing that basically these extreme right wing people have picked up on this tragic, on the tragic deaths of these three young men, and they've made something out of it. In particular, they're trying to say that it wasn't just the police didn't cooperate well with the parents or investigate fully. They allege that this was possibly a terrorist attack, they're inferring by Muslims, on the three young men. But it's very complicated, and to my mind, the Daily Mail article doesn't help investigate matters and set the facts straight. It's weaving an even darker narrative. But let's have a look at the journalist himself. Now, this is from his Twitter page, so this is not a doctored image. And I find this astonishing that a leading Daily Mail reporter would wish to portray himself as what?
Don't know.
Well, if it
a
was
buffoon.
A buffoon, thank you. I could think of a number of words, but this is the way that anybody that dares challenge the Daily Mail or the government is portrayed, as a sort of tinfoil wearing, hat wearing person. And yet this is how Guy Adams seems to see himself. So he says, feats for the Daily Mail plus blather about cricket, tennis, fishing, real tennis, Welsh rugby, malt whiskey. This doesn't fill me with a lot of confidence about what this man is really about. What did he have to say? Well, one of the things he picks up on is that the families claimed that they didn't quite believe what the police had to say. He says it wasn't true. And he says it's not true because the Daily Mail checked the court record. So let's have a look at what was said. In pursuit of evidence to support their claims, Our Boys Justice, this is one of the so-called right-wing groups who've picked up on the case, asked why police accident investigators found the driver to have been in control of the car when he mounted the pavement, claiming such a phrase suggested he deliberately drove at the teenagers. And the inference of that is that if he deliberately drove at the teenagers, this was actually some form of hate or terrorist attack. So the Daily Mail goes on to say, in fact, court documents obtained by the Mail show something very different. An eyewitness, a female friend of the boys called Evie Hansen, was said to have described the driver as having lost control of the car and said that the car had spun around in the middle of the road. Court papers added, tyre marks later found showed the car spun around in a circle three times. Now, Guy Adams, in weaving his story, is very quick to pick up on the fact that Russia Today got involved, which they did, except that Russia Today broadcast an interview with the father of one of the boys, and the father said this. It was Ian Rice, the father of Harry Rice, who was unfortunately killed. The father said, the car turned up the pavement to hit two boys who were luckily thrown clear. Then he, the driver, continued along the railings and the wall and killed the three young men. He then spun the car. Now, we don't know the full facts. We're simply commenting on this Daily Mail article. But for me, what the Daily Mail journalist says does not match what the father of one of the killed young men says. And we could ask why this is, leaving aside any intervention with right-wing groups. So that is just one question. But let's have a look at how it weaves through. We have the young men killed. We quickly bring in Tommy Robinson. We bring in the protest group, which is a right-wing, supposedly right-wing group that picks up the family's case. We get the link in with this man, Goddard, who's now been big in the press with Anne Soubry. We bring in Gerard Batten, and here he is, as I said, with the mother of one of the boys, and Mr. Goddard himself. So the Daily Mail appears to be, yes, picking up on the fact it's almost like a right wing is being created here. And the Daily Mail is giving them a lot of publicity. But then it gets interesting because one of the things he said is other recent online posts by the group have referred to alleged satanic paedophile rings in Hampstead. Well, where did that come from? I'm not too sure. And this is where it ends. They form part of a growing movement of people for whom everything is a conspiracy and establishment cover-up, despite the clear and obvious facts denying their case. So according to the Daily Mail, the problem at the moment is just too many people are challenging the establishment, and that is a conspiracy theory. Because we can trust all of the evidence that the establishment brings forward. I find this quite remarkable. Guy Adams doesn't really pick up on this aspect of his story, that the driver of the car, Janish Chadsasama, pleaded guilty to three counts of causing death by dangerous driving. He was originally given 13 years. On appeal, this was reduced by 2.5 years. So he gets... Sorry, that should be 10 and a half there, shouldn't it? Should be. He gets a 10 and a half year sentence. Whereas if we go to the Hampstead case, a woman gets 9 years for supposedly online harassment. but the journalist doesn't talk about that. I'm very suspicious about this article, Mike. I think if you analyse it, it's helping to ramp up the angst in society. But maybe Guy Adams is just a bell-headed journalist. Mm.
Yes, indeed. Well, look, we're going to end on this one. Now, this is Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe. We mentioned her on Friday's programme, if you want to go back and look at that. She has begun a three-day hunger strike in protest against being denied medical care in Iran. She, of course, was in prison in Iran for 5 years. She was sentenced in 2016 after being convicted of spying, and she absolutely denies that she was spying. Her husband said that the prison officials have refused to allow Nazanin to see a doctor to examine lumps in her breast and other health issues. Now, of course, as we've mentioned many times, that type of thing happens in this country. If we mention Melanie Shaw at this point, she also hasn't had medical treatment. But anyway, nonetheless, we criticise Iran for that. Now, Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe in prison, and I'm not saying that she's guilty of anything at this point. I have no evidence to suggest that she is. But one of the things that fascinated me, particularly in the BBC article, was that she was described as an aid worker, as a charity worker. But of course, she's no such thing. She did work for a charity, but it was a very special charity, BBC Media Action. And we just want to bring on screen at this point a quote from Juliet Harkin, who's formerly BBC Media Action. She's now at East Anglia University, I believe. She said, "We, BBC Action, BBC Media Action, worked in 2004 with individuals within the Syrian ministry who wanted change and tried to get them to be the drivers of that." And she went on to say, "All media development work that has been done in Syria has, in my opinion, been predicated upon the idea that there can be change from within. You have an authoritarian regime and you find who are the reformers within that and you work with them." Now, around the time that Juliet Harkin was talking about here, Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe was working as a project manager for BBC Media Action. I don't know whether she was working on the Syrian projects at all. But nonetheless, this is the type of activity that BBC Media Action was involved in a foreign country. We'll come on to what the implications of that are in a second. In the meantime, Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, when she was arrested in Iran and convicted, had been working for this organisation, the Thomson Reuters Foundation, and they are also into media development in foreign countries. The Thomson Reuters Foundation is committed to fostering the highest standards of journalism worldwide. We believe accurate, impartial and independent journalism leads to better informed societies. It holds power to account, strengthens the rule of law and contributes to economic and social development. Well, I don't believe that there's too much of holding power to account being done by Reuters or any other mainstream media in UK or in the United States or in Europe, never mind in other parts of the world. But let's just have a run through what they say they're doing. They believe in accurate and independent media leading to a better informed society, so they hold power to account and so on. They go on to talk about examples. They provide training, they provide project grants, they provide mentoring, they provide distribution and fellowships. These are very similar types of programs to the ones the BBC Media Action provides. So it's not a surprise that Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe went on to work for this organisation, because it's really a continuation of what she'd been doing for Media Action. What else are they talking about here? From photojournalism workshops to independent news agencies, we run programmes on every continent tailored to real needs. And they go on to say, since 1983, we have worked in over 170 countries around the world with over 15,000 journalists. What are they doing with these people? The Reuters, and then this is a side project for the foundation. The Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism was established in 2006 with the core funding from the Thomson Reuters Foundation. It marks the collaborative commitment between the University of Oxford and the foundation to create an international research centre on the comparative study of journalism. So this is a type of thing that these types of organisations are involved in, but it's not charitable work and it's not aid. Because it's not providing food for hungry people. This is about, if you believe the Juliet Harkin quote, this is about interfering in other countries, which other countries may view as spying. But anyway, we'll come on to that in a second. And we've got to put this in a bit of context of Integrity Initiative and the Foreign and Commonwealth Office's counter disinformation program. And remember what we said from Friday. This financial year, the Foreign Office is investing approximately £8 million in supporting public service and independent media. This includes projects in the Baltic states, Ukraine, as well as pan-regional initiatives. In addition, we're working with governments in the Baltic states alongside the British Council and other partners to address issues such as media literacy and societal integration. Well, I just want to highlight one organisation here. Here we go. The WFD, the Westminster Foundation for Democracy. And there's Mr. Burko on the right there because he's very proudly associated with this. It's the UK's public body dedicated to supporting democracy around the world. WFD's initiatives include helping protect women from violence in the Middle East, making politics more inclusive in Africa, consolidating democratic institutions in Asia, building trust in democracy across the Western Balkans. On behalf of the United Kingdom, WFD recruits international election observers and leads the Commonwealth Partnership for Democracy, a UK initiative to support the political engagement of minorities and vulnerable groups in developing countries in the Commonwealth. So, first glance, this doesn't look like journalism or media necessarily. But just to give one example, between 2008 and 2013, WFD led a partnership including UK Parliament, UK National Audit Office, the UK branch of the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association and the Thomson Reuters Foundation. The partnership helped establish parliamentary study centres in Lebanon, Uganda, Mozambique, a parliamentary public accounts committee in Morocco, freedom of information legislation in Ukraine, and a human rights committee in Uganda. Now, this is, they call themselves an independent public body supported by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and UK aid. But look, when you've got organisations like this, working with organisations like Thomson Reuters Foundation, BBC Media Action, the Foreign Office is not going to fund an independent public body which is doing anything other than following British foreign policy. It's not able to operate independently of what the Foreign Office says is the right thing to do. Therefore, this is British soft power, whether it's called independent or not. If Thomson Reuters Foundation and BBC Media Action are working with organisations like this to play the games that they're playing in other countries, this is British soft power. Now, I don't know whether Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe knew what she was doing. I don't know if she knew what she was doing. I don't know if she was guilty or of spying in Iran or not. I'm quite willing to presume that she is innocent of it. But when people go and work for these types of organisations, Brian, which have clear political aims in other countries, it's maybe unsurprising that individuals then get caught up in the trouble that follows or that comes along afterwards.
Indeed. David, we're running out of time. Just 30 seconds to close on that one.
Yeah, sure. When a good friend of mine, Lisa, when the going got tough in campaigning in Brexit, she often used to come out with this very much a sort of a right and wrong, you know, just lets everybody do the right thing. And she often used to use this phrase. It sort of goes back to Stalin and Hitler. So over the time frame that we're talking about with this problem, and she used to say this, you know, they come for the Jews and I did nothing. Pretty soon they'll come for the Christians. And if you do nothing, they come for the Sikhs and you do nothing. They come for the Hindus and you do nothing. They've already come from our miners and we did nothing. They've come for our steel workers and we did nothing. They've come for our car workers and we've done nothing. They're now coming for our Royal Navy and our Royal Marines. We're doing nothing. When they take your family, who will be there left to help you? You'll be on your own.
David, thank you very much. Very poignant words. Very, very accurate, I think. What we're witnessing is a dictatorship. We'll use that term at the moment, coming into force in UK with the help of the European Union. And what can we do to stop it? Well, of course, the key weapon is exposure. This is so important. Violence is not needed. It simply plays into their hands. But exposing what is happening is very important. We'll end there. Thank you all for joining us today. And a very big thank you to our overseas viewers. We know you're there. And we're very grateful to learn that people in some numbers are starting to tune into UK Column to focus on our analysis of what's happening in UK. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.